The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests. A former reviews editor at Publishers Weekly, Jasmine Chan holds an MFA from Columbia University. Her debut novel, The School for Good Mothers, is not a domestic manual on keeping house. It forces the reader to contend with an uncomfortable question. If the state were to quantify what it means to be a good mother, would I pass the test? A reviewer for Wired writes, "This book is a horror story so potent it will fill even the most diligent parent with an itchy impulse to panic clean, to straighten up, to act like someone's watching. A mother reading it doesn't close the book, sigh, and think, 'Thank God the world's not really like this.' No, she closes it and knows she must be very careful." This evening, she'll be joined in conversation with Liz Moore, the best-selling author of Long Bright River, The Words of Every Song, Heft, and The Unseen World. We're glad to present this event in collaboration with Blue Stoop, a home for Philly writers. Offering rigorous classes in the craft of writing and free weekly drop-in programs and other community events, Blue Stoop nurtures an inclusive literary community. Please join me in welcoming our guests to the Free Library.
Hi, everyone. It's so nice to be doing an in-person event in Philadelphia in particular. It really is. And I think, Jasmine, this is your first in-person event for this book. Is that right?
So the only in-person events I'm doing are here in Philly and then Harrisburg tomorrow.
Yes. So it's an extra
thank
special
thank you to everyone for coming out.
For many reasons. I'm sure many of you know this already, but Jasmine lived in Philadelphia until very recently. How many years did you live in Philadelphia?
We lived here for 7 years. Can you hear me okay? The mic is okay. So we lived here for 7 years, but it felt like longer because I got engaged, married, pregnant, had a baby, raised a baby here. So all the big adult milestones.
Many life events. Yeah.
Many life events.
I am really glad that you had all of those milestones in Philadelphia because that also is where I met Jasmine. First, as I guess part of this writers group that we're part of, which I have relates to one of the questions that I'll ask Jasmine, and also because you used your time in Philadelphia as inspiration for the setting for this incredible novel. I don't know how many of you have had the chance to read it yet, but it's truly remarkable. It was unlike anything that I had read. I remember when I first read it, I must have emailed you, Jasmine, at the end, just because I felt, you know, my jaw was sort of on the floor, and I was just like, this is one of the most emotionally powerful conclusions to a novel that I've ever read, and it also marked for me one of the most sustained, the longest sustained period of crying that I might have ever had at the conclusion of a book. But it was earned. It was really worth it. So for those of you who haven't read it yet, please buy this book and read it. It's truly wonderful. Jasmine, I'm going to start by asking you to just like orient the book a little bit for those who haven't had a chance to read it. Tell just like sort of a paragraph long description of the story, if you feel like it, and then maybe if you wouldn't mind reading just very briefly from the opening, that might help to guide people.
Well, first, thank you for feeling all the feelings. I've been describing the book as not the most relaxing read, but hopefully worthwhile.
Very, very.
So I have been hearing about a lot of tears. So I very much appreciate everyone not just reading, but investing in the story. So the story is about a Chinese-American single mom named Frida Liu, who lives in Philly and is really struggling to balance motherhood with her job and wasn't expecting to be a single parent, feels very overwhelmed. And she has one very bad day where she ends up leaving her toddler home alone. And as a result of that bad day, it sets off a chain of events in which she ends up at an imaginary government-run reform school where she's re-educated with mothers from around the county and has to spend a year there in order to get her child back. I like to describe it as sort of like 1984, but for moms. So I'm going to read the first two pages. We have your daughter. It's the first Tuesday in September, the afternoon of her one very bad day, and Frida is trying to stay on the road. On the voicemail, the officer tells her to come to the station immediately. She pauses the message, puts down her phone. It's 2:46 p.m. She meant to get home an hour and a half ago. She pulls onto the first side street off Gray's Ferry and double parks. She calls back and begins apologizing, explaining that she lost track of time. Is she okay? The officer says the child is safe. Ma'am, we've been trying to reach you. Frida hangs up and calls Gust, has to leave a message. He needs to meet her at the station at 11th and Wharton. There's a problem. It's Harriet. Her voice catches. She repeats the officer's promise that their daughter is safe. As she begins driving again, she reminds herself to stay under the speed limit, to avoid running red lights, to breathe. All through Labor Day weekend, she felt frantic. Last Friday and Saturday, she had her usual insomnia, sleeping 2 hours each night. On Sunday, when Gus dropped off Harriet for Frida's 3.5 days of custody, Harry was in the throes of an ear infection. That night, Frida slept 90 minutes, last night an hour. Harriet's crying has been relentless, too big for her body, too loud for the walls of their tiny house to absorb. Frida did what she could. She sang lullabies, rubbed Harriet's chest, gave her extra milk. She laid on the floor next to Harriet's crib, held her impossibly perfect hand through the bars, kissed her knuckles, her fingernails, feeling for the ones that needed to be trimmed, praying for Harriet's eyes to close. The afternoon sun is burning as Frida pulls up to the station, located 2 blocks from her house in an old Italian neighborhood in South Philly. She parks and rushes to the reception desk, asks if the receptionist has seen her daughter, a toddler, 18 months old, half Chinese, half white, big brown eyes, curly dark brown hair with bangs. You must be the mother, the receptionist says.
Thank you very much, Jasmine. I typically like to start any interview I do with the same question for authors, which is not, what was your inspiration for this book, which I find a terrible question and like far too big. Instead, I'd like to ask you about the first spark that arrived to you of this book, by which I mean, was it an image, a character, a line of dialogue, a scene, a setting? What sort of visited you first about this book?
So this is a pretty unusual experience for me, writing project-wise, because this is really the only time when the project arrived really fully formed. I didn't know it was going to be a novel, but Frida's very bad day grew out of my really good writing day in early 2014. So at the time, I had gotten rejected from McDowell & Yotto for like the 10th time. And so I took my vacation days and went to a friend's house in upstate New York for about 2 weeks and was snowed in, was very alone, but felt very free creatively. So I was really just coming up with one terrible story idea after another, but then one day I wrote for 6 hours, like in a trance. And it's been funny answering the question of where it came from, because the whole arc of the story was there from pretty much that day, because that day's messy draft resulted in Frida's whole arc from start to finish, her relationship with Harriet, the Gust and Susanna story, the women pink lab coat and the dolls. So the voice of the school was there from the very beginning. So I emerged thinking a few weeks later, in the back of my mind, there's a tiny voice that said, maybe this could be a novel. Right. But it was really a workshop at Breadloaf that summer where Percival Everett said, I think you have a novel here. And I think without that push, it would have just been a very complicated short story that wouldn't have grown into a book.
I read another interview that you did where you mentioned that workshop with Percival Everett and something else he said.
Oh, wait,
wait. Don't say it yet. I want to return to that.
Okay.
I have this in mind. We're starting in the middle of things, and then we're going to return to backstory. I'm sort of like crafting this interview like a novel as we go. The backstory is, can you tell us a little bit? This is your debut novel, and it's sort of like the debut novel of anyone's dreams. It's gotten so much wonderful, deserved publicity. It was a pick for the Today Show's book club this month, which many of you may know. It's just earning a lot of acclaim, and it's wonderful when that happens, not only to a deserving book, but also to a deserving person.
Thank you, Liz.
But this was your debut, so can you just tell me and the audience a little bit about your journey to writing that first novel? Like, what, you know, did you do an MFA? Tell me about your career as a writer prior to this novel.
I'll begin by saying it was a very long, slow journey because I'm publishing my first novel at 43, but I started writing fiction when I was 18. So a lot of it was about not quitting. So I did creative writing undergrad, worked at the University of Chicago for most of my 20s, went to Columbia for grad school at 30, then started working at Publishers Weekly right after that. But writing a first book was always the dream, but I really thought I would debut with a short story collection because that's what felt possible. Because I write at a snail's pace and I write longhand, and the idea of writing a novel felt like this impossible thing that might take 22 years. So the first book really did take about 25 years, but not the writing of the book, more the process of learning and growing in order to be able to write this novel.
Do you think, I won't ask you like what are you working on or what your plans are for the future, but do you anticipate that that's just your process as a writer and that you require a certain amount of time for your ideas to form in that way? Or do you feel like you might, now that you've done it once?
I certainly hope it's not going to take this long to write a second novel. I certainly don't want to give my publisher a heart attack by suggesting that it is. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm probably going to scribble and come up with new ideas and play around. I've never been someone who can sit down with a plan or an outline and say, I'm starting a book now. This is what it's going to be about. Because I definitely have to find my way in, and I tend to be really critical of myself and have a hard time tuning out all the voices that says like, oh, this isn't going to go anywhere and I'll never finish it. So I think I will find my way to a new project eventually, but I can't yet tell what it's going to be about.
Sure. All right, let's go back to Percival Everett. You took a workshop of his at Breadloaf, and this was a conversation that I read between you and Crystal Hannah Kim. You showed an early piece of this novel to Percival Everett. Can you tell the audience what else he said about it? He said, I think you might have a novel, and he said...
So he began it by saying, mm-hmm. I don't want to make your life bad, but I think you have a novel here. Mm-hmm. And after a few years of writing, I really understood what he meant, because he described it as a novel was a long, difficult marriage. Mm-hmm. And it is in the sense that you have to recommit to it. Like for me, I felt like I was recommitting to it every day and just giving myself a little pep talk. My bulletin board doesn't have story stuff. It's just all little pep talk notes from my friends. But I could see why he both wanted to encourage me, but also warn me that it was going to be hard.
And I think, if I'm remembering, I don't remember the exact line, but he said something like, and by the way, you also seem to have your finger on the pulse of a really precise cultural moment. I might be mangling those words.
He said, I think what he said was, if you manage to write the book,
yeah,
you'll have your finger on the pulse of culture.
Right, right.
Which was very exciting to hear, but also like, how do I do that?
So that was sort of my question. When somebody tells you that, it is a gift, when somebody says, you're actually, this feels extremely fresh and timely, but there's also a certain amount, for me anyway, of anxiety about like, but what if I'm just part of a zeitgeist and there's going to be like 80,000 novels coming out about exactly this in 4 years or whenever mm-hmm. I finish it? Is that so the good news is your novel came out however many years later. It still feels incredibly fresh and timely, perhaps timelier than ever, in the way that it deals with the sort of anxieties of parenting, and more specifically mothering, in amidst a society that does not offer much at all in the way of social support. But did you sort of, was that always a question in the back of your mind? Will I be part of a zeitgeist? Will it still feel original in 6 years or whatever it was?
Well, I started in 2014 and we sold the book in 2019, but then where it was originally supposed to come out summer 2021 and then got moved till now. And I mean, it was a long process also from the point when you sell a book to when it actually is in readers' hands. And I think there was a moment, I think, in 2019 where there was, I think, New York Times articles about the new motherhood novels, and I thought, I've missed this moment. but I couldn't have predicted how timely the book is now, because it's timely in kind of a sad way, because it's not like I wanted the world to be as grim as it is now. But I couldn't have imagined the conversations that people are having about motherhood and the pressures on parents. So it's coming out at a time when women's rights are under attack and when there's so much extra pressure on parents and especially on moms. So it's entering an important conversation, but it's kind of sad that that's the state of things.
All right, let's talk about the actual mistake that Frida makes at the start of the novel, which I read this book in galley form, would have been, 6 months ago, probably something like that.
I think I asked you for a blurb the day before the election,
and you
kindly said yes, even though we were all having a heart attack that day.
It's been a long time. Time is a flat circle. It no longer makes sense. I want to ask about that act. So can you describe the actual mistake that Frida makes? It happens so early on in the book that I don't think it would spoil anything.
So Frida leaves her 18-month-old baby in an extra saucer, and she intends to be gone for 10 minutes to go get an iced coffee, but she hasn't slept in many nights and decides to drive to work in West Philly, even though she lives in South Philly. And she ends up writing a lot of emails, catching up on work that she couldn't get done at home, and losing track of time. So one thing that has come up with the question of how bad of a parenting mistake that was, I've been asked by a couple of different people, like, why did you make her do something truly bad? And in one of the times when I went back to Breadloaf, a lot of the workshop classmates suggested that I have her do something more innocent, like run into the store while the baby sits in the back seat and grab your wallet off the counter, like something where she's a truly innocent person fighting against state oppression, because that's also a compelling narrative. But I decided not to do that because it didn't feel like an interesting story to me. And I really wanted to write a Chinese American heroine who was actually messy and who actually did something bad, so that she had to really reckon with her guilt and shame, because that felt like a really important story to tell.
I loved that about Frida, and I actually have noticed in this moment that a lot of characters are being granted permission to be messy, as you put it, who wouldn't have been a decade ago or even 5 years ago. She is messy. She's a sexual being. She is a sort of a clingy being. She has feelings for her husband, who is her recent ex-husband, who is by all accounts a kind of a terrible character. Although he has a certain
but he's a
element
nice person, though.
He's a nice person. Yeah, I don't know. I hated Gus. I loved that you made the decision to actually let her make that mistake. And my question was going to be, like, sort of how did you decide, which you kindly answered, but also, like, where else did you get pushback on that? Did it become a question that you had to go back and forth on with your editor, for example? You had two editors. Did either of them urge you to either tone up or down the severity of the mistake that Frida made?
I'm going to answer that in a kind of circular way.
You may.
So, yeah. So I forgot to give credit where credit is due, which is part of the idea for the story came from a New Yorker article by Rachel Aviv, which came out in 2013 called Where Is Your Mother?, which I encourage everyone to read. It's a completely heartbreaking story. And I think the idea for the inciting incident came from there, because that was about a single mom who left her toddler son at home for a number of hours, and after that day never got him back. And she goes through a really nightmarish experience with the family court system, and it follows all of her ups and downs with social workers and family court judges. So that's where the idea of a mom walking away for a number of hours came from. But it's a lot of the idea for the story was emotionally coming from my ambivalence about having a baby and freaking out about that. So I dealt with my ambivalence by writing a dystopian novel, and my daughter will forgive me for one day.
Or else she will write a memoir about the child of a writer, and that is our comeuppance. I also have young children, and I'm fully prepared that one day they may be writers, and I will be like John Cheever, and in my dreams, I will be like John Cheever. But I'm prepared. I think that's the bargain that you enter into. You have the freedom to write what you wish, and your children also do.
She's going to grow up with a whole shelf of feminist dystopian novels. Like, so she'll turn 12 and be like, okay, let me read The Handmaid's Tale now. But you were asking if I got any pushback on Frida's Bad Day. We did change a few things in the editing. And I think we softened some of the severity, like in the earlier drafts, the book, which is very dark, was even darker, and because that's where my brain goes when I write fiction, and I was encouraged to like add more warmth and light and humor so there'd be balance in the story. And what changed during the edits was that Frida left Harriet alone for 2.5 hours rather than 4. So I think it was decided that 4 was really stretching the reader's tolerance for getting on board with this character. And I think we gave Frida a more plausible reason to leave the house, because I think in earlier drafts I'd written that she just needed to be alone. And so I think we added a lot more about her job.
Yeah.
Because that, I think, felt like that added a different element to the story. But I think we also added her reckoning with her guilt a lot more later on.
Yeah. It was great. And and I did notice whether because of the edits that you're referring to in which she was softened, or because you always had this instinct, how much she loves her daughter is so apparent. And I found myself particularly heartbroken by a moment when, even when she's already being taken into custody, she feels this urge to call her ex and say, don't forget to give her a bath and don't forget to feed her dessert because I promised her ice cream. And it's just, as a parent of young children, I just was like, that's exactly right. That instinct to always have a mental checklist of everything that your child needs and always be so tuned in to like their bodily needs and wants and necessities. It's, you rendered that so well. It sounds like you began this book pre-motherhood and finished it post-motherhood.
I began this several years before getting pregnant, and then after having a baby, I had to rewrite the whole thing.
Yeah, so tell me about that. How did you have new insights?
There were new insights once I think when my daughter was about 10 months old was probably when I was able to like actually concentrate again. But besides the new insights, I got so many details wrong about child development in the early drafts. I think Frida spoke to Harriet for pages and pages because Harriet spoke in paragraphs because I didn't know that an 18-month-old doesn't talk that much. And I had the moms bathing the toddler dolls in sinks because I didn't know how big a toddler was. And
just a tiny genius. That's what an
18-month-old is. Yes. I had the moms running through actual fire. And I think I didn't understand that getting a small child from point A to point B, or to do anything that you need them to do, is this ordeal, and that you go through all this whole operatic set of emotions and you feel like your whole life is ending and this is just trying to get the shoes on in the morning. So once I had a clue of what the struggles of daily life was like with a small willful being, I think I toned down a lot of the lessons and I really simplified them. There were too many lessons, but also they were just too hard. So I had new lessons with trying to convince the dolls not to drop food. I wrote in a lot of the parenting challenges into the story.
Yeah, there's so much food on my floor right now.
Right.
As we speak, so much. Okay, so the middle of the book is, I think of this book as having sort of like three acts. There's there's life before the school mm-hmm. for good mothers, there's life at the school, and then there's this finale that I won't give anything away about. But at the school, when Frida goes to this rehabilitation program, it's so suspenseful, and yet we're in one location for the entire time. I would find that challenging as a writer, to sort of come up with new daily tasks to maintain a sense of suspense throughout. How did you do that? Was that a challenge for you, or did it come very naturally?
I wouldn't say that any of the book came naturally, except for that very first mm-hmm. draft at the beginning. That mm-hmm. came very naturally, and I think I was always struggling to get back to mm-hmm. that sense of being lost in the moment when you're writing. But I think the suspense really came in the editing. Mm-hmm. And my background and my work life was always as an editor, and I'm someone who really likes to cut stuff, which is why I write longhand, because if I worked on the machine on screen, I would just cut everything as I went. Mm-hmm. And I think I really chose to build suspense by when I ended scenes, when I ended chapters. So the suspense is not just in the story, but on the like sentence or paragraph level. So I was trying to keep up the momentum that way.
Is that something? So that is something that you sort of intentionally think about as a writer: story, suspense, narrative tension. That's all. Those are all parts of the equation that you're thinking about.
I think a lot about movement. Mm-hmm. I think a lot about sound and movement. Mm-hmm. And I think my editors would tell you that I could stand to think more about theme and intentions, because during the editing process, they would ask, well, what were you trying to do here? And I would say, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And so we had that conversation a few times. And it's been interesting in launching the book to have to put a narrative on something that was just intuitive, yeah. that it was just trial and error for years and years until it was right, rather than saying I'm going in here and this is what I intend to do.
Right. Okay. Without spoiling the ending in terms of like what actually happened, I'm interested in knowing when it arrived to you in the writing process. Could you? Some writers say, I knew the beginning of the book and I knew the end, but I didn't know how to get there. Some writers say, 3/4 of the way through the writing process, the ending arrived to me, and then I knew it was almost done. When did you know how the book would end? Or did the ending change?
I think I had an inkling of the ending from that very first day when there was the whole draft, because that really became the foundation for my work for the next few years. But the crazy story about writing the ending of the book was that, and I'm trying to talk about it more, even though it's like kind of mortifying to talk about too, because I really feel like this subject is not talked about openly enough, was my internist had taken me off antidepressants because I was thinking of trying to have a baby. And that is a hard thing to do. And it put me in a really shaky place with my mental health. And so a fair amount of suffering went into the creation of my daughter and the creation of my book. And I was going through a really hard time when writing the very last scene. So mm-hmm. I think chapter 18 does have some of that raw desperation. Mm-hmm. That was really how I felt in that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Changing topics slightly, I'm wondering, so you moved to Chicago, back to Chicago. You grew up outside Chicago, in Chicago?
I grew up in Oak Park, a western suburb of Chicago.
And that is now where you live, or near there. How has it been for you? How has the transition back to Chicago been for you in a pandemic? What's it like?
I wish I had more colorful stories for you, but basically we stayed in our house in mm-hmm. West Philly for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. We emerged for about 3 weeks, mm-hmm. as everyone did during the post-vaccine beautiful time, where I hung out with several of the people in this audience, and we ate meals and hung out each other's living rooms again, and it was really beautiful. And then we moved back to Oak Park so that my family could live closer to my parents. And we have mostly been in our apartment mm-hmm. during that time. So part of the excitement in coming here is I haven't actually met any readers before today, and I've just been in my apartment for the launch until literally yesterday.
Yeah, it is. There is a very different energy, I find, to doing a sort of in-person event and doing a virtual event. So I'm delighted that this is your first one. here in Philadelphia, when you lived here, we were part of the same group of writers. And we would meet once a month or so at somebody's house pre-pandemic and then virtually early pandemic and then on somebody's outdoor space in the middle of the pandemic. Is that something that you think you may come to have in Chicago? And is it important to you to be in a community of writers? Or are you, do you identify as a more solitary writer?
This is a good question that I've never actually thought about that much. I think I do really derive a lot of life joy from being in a community with a lot of other writers. I'm told that I can still be a satellite member of the Claw and just
I don't know if we've taken that vote yet.
Okay. Well, I'm still on the email list, mm-hmm. occasionally chiming in. But the Claw was really special because I was so intimidated when I got the email from you inviting me to join this very special group of incredibly successful people.
Me specifically?
Yes. You sent the email, and I think Carmen had suggested that you contact me, but at that time, I was just friend of Carmen, and so I don't think I had the full manuscript done yet, and when I went to the first Claw meeting, everyone had published 3 books and had a tenure-track jobs, and so I was super intimidated, and as I went through the different stages, it was so important to have the Claw ladies cheering me along from finishing the book to getting ready to query agents, to signing with an agent, to going on submission. It was really exciting to celebrate each of those milestones. I don't quite know how to do that in Chicago because it's a much bigger city. So it was really handy that like half the Claw lived in West Philly within like 2 blocks of each other.
Yeah, Philadelphia has gotten to have this momentum within fiction that, you know, Philadelphia has always been a really strong writing city, especially in poetry. And certainly it has a history of fiction, but for whatever reason, there's been a lot of momentum around Philadelphia-produced fiction lately, and that's been really nice. I wonder, like, for you, do you have early readers that you give your work to? Are they other writers? Are they family members or friends?
Oh, they're definitely not family members. But I do have a few friends who mm-hmm. I would send work to. So my friends Keith and Yvonne were, like, the like guiding lights in finishing the book, and they signed on I think probably sometime in 2018 to, and I said, you know, it would really help me if I could send you guys each chapter mm-hmm. as I wrote it. Mm-hmm. And that I think I actually got that idea from Hanya Yanagihara's talk mm-hmm. here, because I think she talked about how she was accountable to someone mm-hmm. in order to get her draft done. And so they were my partners in accountability, and I sent them a chapter at a time for probably 2 years. Mm-hmm. And it was really meaningful that they would say, I want to know what happens next. Mm-hmm. And Keith actually came up with a lot of the ideas for mm-hmm. the dolls, because mm-hmm. I am a complete Luddite, and I don't really know how to use Google Docs. Instagram Live gives me a heart attack. Mm-hmm. So I wrote about technology, but I actually am not a tech person. So he supplied a lot of the great ideas for how the machines actually operate.
You incorporated them very convincingly. I felt I had a really tactile sense of what the dolls would be like. And I found myself extremely invested in both the star doll, the main character doll.
I like that you called her the star
she's
doll.
She's the star. Yeah, she is. So this will be my last question for Jasmine, and then we will invite as many questions from the audience as we can get. The book was recently optioned for television, which I know is never a guarantee, but should the TV series be made, what would be your hopes for it, or can you talk a little bit about hopes and expectations around an adaptation of your work? Would you be involved in the adaptation, first of all, or are you just outsourcing that and letting others take the reins?
Well, I'm signed as an executive producer, which is very surreal and very exciting. The pieces of the team that have been announced are the product, so it's optioned by Jessica Chastain's production company, Freckle Films, with Endeavor Content as the studio. And I'm mentioning Endeavor Content because they actually produced The Lost Daughter.
Oh my God,
it's been really exciting to see my book written about alongside The Lost Daughter and to be part of that conversation. Mm-hmm. And the director, Jude Wang, has been announced too. So I think my hopes, well, my hopes are for it to get made. Right. And then when that piece is clearly happening, I think it's just really exciting to have the potential for a one-hour drama centered on an Asian American point of view as the center of the story, and to be telling a story about American society but with an Asian American lead, because that is pretty rare still, even now. And I know there have been some very exciting shows coming out that have been out in the last few years with Asian leads, but it's not the norm by any by anyone's standards. So I think that will be really exciting, and I think that Frida's potentially an Asian American lead that we haven't necessarily seen before on screen.
Yeah, I hope it gets made so that I can see how they do the dolls. That's my hope.
Some of my friends who are in the audience want their children to be extras.
And wait, as the dolls?
As the dolls. But the problem is Hollywood is slow, so their children might be too old.
They might have aged out. Sorry, but, friends in the audience.
I'm still going to put in the request. Yeah. I may not have that kind of power, but they've been talking about it for years.
If anyone's pregnant or secretly pregnant in the audience right now, the timing might be perfect. So talk to Jasmine after.
If you're willing to have your child be an extra on
a
kind of dark story.
Actually, you know what's interesting? This is the last thing I'll say. They weren't creepy dolls. They were beloved, lovely dolls. They weren't creepy. I got very invested in those dolls. I apologize to them for calling them creepy. All right, would anyone like to ask questions? There is a microphone someplace toward the back, and someone will run it up to you. I will call on you from up here, from this vantage point. I see a hand right here in the third row, the middle of the third row. Could you raise your hand again? There you go.
I think I know who's under this mask.
I know, it's true. The masks sort of hide identities.
Thank you. You had mentioned short stories, and I just wanted to know a little bit more. Is that something that you're working on, something that we might get a hold of, and what might be the themes?
Dorit, you're asking really hard questions, but thank you. I want to get back to writing short stories just because it feels like a more possible place to start working on new ideas. I mean, the idea of starting a new novel is very exciting, but it takes a while to figure out what you want to harness your life to, because I mean, this book was what I harnessed my life to through my mid-30s to my early 40s, which is a big chunk of one's adulthood, and I think I want to see what story I'm going to get obsessed with. I mean, all my fiction that I've ever written has been about women and desire and shame and guilt and female sexuality and family relationships. So, I mean, I know that it's possible for me to write a male narrator, but I might not ever do it because I'm just really interested in telling women's stories.
So aside from having, I guess, firsthand experience living in Philly, what was your thought process behind choosing Philly as a setting as opposed to, like, Chicago or New York or another place that you might have experience in?
I think the book ended up being set here partly because I had just moved here. And I think when I wrote the first draft, I was still living in Brooklyn. I think setting it in New York is a very different story. And I think if you write a protagonist who's a stressed out Brooklyn mom, that has a different set of cultural markers associated with it. So, and I didn't necessarily want it to be a book about New York necessarily, and I was really invested in trying to learn about the city right when I started working the project was right after we moved. And so part of Frida's path through the city is just me teaching myself where everything was. And I actually used, I actually used the campus of Swarthmore as an inspiration.
I was wondering. For the school, for Good
Mother. For the school, and so, sorry, Swarthmore, but Swarthmore had, so I visited Haverhill, so late in the editing process, my agent had kindly said, or gently said, you know, the setting details are a touch random. And so she suggested that I really build out the world of the school a little more. And so I went on a little field trip to Haverford and Swarthmore. Haverford was very beautiful, but Swarthmore had a bell tower, which I really needed for parts of the story. And so the story changed at that point to include the beauty of the Swarthmore campus, so that it was actually even more eerie to have the moms trapped in a beautiful place that was huge. Mm-hmm. So then it has a suggestion of like how many more women are there going to be in coming years, because it can hold thousands.
Right. Interesting. I wondered if it were modeled on a specific campus or a specific place. I'm very
My sister went to college there, and I remember visiting thinking, what is this? Why is it so nice? Like, why didn't I get this college experience? Because it's really idyllic and it's so gigantic and there's so few people.
I feel like there might be some people in the audience who have affiliations there, because I've heard some knowing chuckles. But I too visited there as a high school student and did not end up applying, probably because I realized I couldn't get in. But anyway, I just remember the grass being like incredibly green and dewy. That's what I remember about it. It was just like so idyllic and pastoral.
Yeah, I used the campus map to guide some of the moms' tasks and places where they could go to get lost or get up to no good. And that really changed the story. And my mom read this. So my parents and I did a little field trip. And so when my mom read the book, she said, "We were only there for an hour. How did you add all this stuff?" But I think whatever it was about visiting really sparked my imagination to like create a lot of extra story.
It can be so helpful to have a specific place in mind when you're describing a fictional place. I want to say one more thing about Philly too, as we wait for another question. It made so much sense to me that she would be working at Penn. And I felt like that too was good reason to set it in Philadelphia. It just felt very right for her to have that job.
So apologies to the other institutions that I'm drawing on, because
just
that
slandering that, in Philly institutions.
It was not slandering Philly. This is a slandering Chicago institution. Yeah. So I'll be an equal opportunity offender here. So that so Frida's terrible job is based on my terrible job at the University of Chicago, which was I think it was terrible in the sense that I wanted to be a novelist, but I was writing about econ for 7 years, not for 6 months as Frida has. And I was really young at the time, so I was like the lowest on the staff totem pole and dealing with very, very powerful professors. So I didn't know that would be useful as a backstory for the character of my first novel.
Right.
So the hard jobs can eventually pay off when you work them into your fiction.
When you wring them dry for your fiction 20 years later. Maybe not 20, no. Any other questions for Jasmine?
Hey, so I know that it took a long time to write the book. Was there ever a moment where you really felt like giving up, and how did you overcome that moment or those moments?
I mean, I felt like giving up like pretty often during the process, but I think the hardest was getting work done after having a baby, because back to talking about antidepressants more openly, I was still on the antidepressants that weren't working for me until my daughter was 10 months old. So at that point, when I was put back on my correct medication, my brain started working again. And I think I just talk about it more now just because it's like this secret suffering that a lot of moms have gone through. And it just feels like it's just too bad that so many people have had to go through that. And it was really hard to get back to work in that state of dealing with a lot of mental health struggles while also feeding a child from your body and not sleeping. And it took a lot to just get my concentration back. And I think the other thing that I've been trying to mention more is that the way that this novel got finished while having a small child was by having childcare support. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't the case that I was up till 6 a.m. every night writing after my child went to bed, or I was homeschooling her all day and then wrote all night. I was able to finish because I had support.
I was listening to you talk about the experience of writing while having young children, even with child care support, there's a certain element of just like the physicality of a very young child's demands that I read parts of this book as a work of horror, just because my youngest child is 2.5, and so this is like very recent history. It's sort of current state for me. I'm just going to read one short paragraph. This is what preceded Frida's very bad day, as Jasmine calls it in the book. They'd been up off and on since 4 a.m. Frida's article was due last week. All morning, she went back and forth between Harriet's play corner and back to the living room sofa, where she had her notes spread out on the coffee table. She wrote the same paragraph over and over, trying to explain Bayesian modeling in layman's terms. Harriet kept screaming. She wanted to climb onto Frida's lap. She wanted to be held. She grabbed Frida's papers and threw them on the floor. She kept touching the keyboard. I think this has been my pandemic experience for 2 years.
It reads differently in 2022.
Yeah. But always there's this element, you know, any mother who's trying to balance caring for very young children with work, I think will find this so resonant. And it's touching to me, it's moving to me to be reading a book that relates this struggle so precisely and actually holding the artifact, the end product of that work in my hands at the same time. That thought occurred to me as I was reading this book. It was sort of like triumph. Like the child did not knock all the pages off.
The child did not knock all the pages off. Right. She did develop these games with her dollhouse where she took all the dollhouse characters and would arrange them in a way that represented waiting for mom to come downstairs from her office. And then she also started playing with our old keyboards, like the old keyboards that I really should throw away but didn't. And so she would bang on them. And so she thinks typing is being a mom. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So she thinks that the only job you can have is a book writer. She will have that bubble burst at some point. But it's nice that she believes this at this moment.
I often get up at 5:30 specifically so that I can to write specifically so that I can be present at breakfast with my children. And yet my daughter has developed the habit of every day when I'm coming down the stairs to join her for breakfast, she'll go, "Mom, are you going to work?" It's like, "No, Annie, I'm coming away from work to join you." It's just like they really twist the
At the moment when a few months ago when it seemed like I was going to be touring and traveling a lot for 6 weeks, I would talk about the tour and I would talk about traveling and she would add, "with your child." So she's very aware of the job that I have and how it needs to include her more.
I mean, noted.
Thanks. So I am really impressed by just how much I'm seeing this book on every single list right now and, you know, on Instagram, other people reading it in every bookstore that I'm going into. And I'm wondering what it's like to be thrust into the spotlight like this, especially as your debut novel.
That's a wildly flattering question to answer, so thank you. You know, what's funny about thinking about it is that I actually have just been in my house for the whole month of January, so I have been in it with all the other parents of small children right now. My daughter just got her second vaccine dose a couple hours ago, which is very, very exciting. But because of the various exposures and having like my parents and then a child who wasn't fully vaccinated yet, we have just been kind of living in a bubble at home and not really going anywhere. So it wasn't until maybe 10 days ago that I even went to more bookstores to see my book and on the main tables before all these things change. And so that was a really special experience. But a lot of it has just felt so surreal because it's been this really exciting career moment at a time when I don't see other humans. So I'm just really grateful to everyone who's come out at a time when indoor gatherings are not easy. And it's been really special to come here to have the first event be here.
That would be really weird.
It has been a little weird because I think it has felt kind of intangible and far away because most of my interaction with readers has been on the internet or through social media. So it's been really fun to answer messages and send a lot of emojis and thank yous, but it has felt kind of intangible.
Right. But like the traditional rite of passage of like the party after your book launch, like that's not, that's something that has been sort of absent from this, despite all the acclaim it's been getting and everything. I hope at some point you can throw a retroactive party for this book. That would be fun.
So I have to say, if you, whenever the world becomes more stable, if you're inclined to throw a party, you should do it, because we sold my book in November 2019 and we couldn't tell anyone about it until January 2020.
Right.
And I think we had just thrown a big children's birthday party and felt like, oh, we can't handle organizing another party right now to celebrate selling the book. And we said, we'll do it later.
Yeah.
And then March 2020 happened, and then we stopped seeing anyone. So,
what is your husband's phone number? I'm going to send a well-timed text message.
So if you're feeling like you should throw a party, you should really just throw a party, because otherwise it'll be 2 years later.
Capture the moments. Yeah, that's good advice.
But it's funny to even think about being thrust into the spotlight, because a lot of my my home life has not changed at all, and I'm just at home. So it's been really exciting. But I think that having a 5-year-old who really doesn't care is very helpful.
Yeah.
We have a funny video on my phone where we got the news about the New York Times bestseller list, which was very exciting, and I told her like, "Mommy made the New York Times bestseller list," and she's just blinking at the camera like, that's nice. So I regularly have someone like keeping me in check.
Yeah, you're good at that. Any final questions for Jasmine? Well, thank you all so much for coming, Jasmine. Congratulations. Let us be the first in person. Can we just give her a round of applause?
Yay!
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's so nice to hear live applause.
I know.
It's so nice. It really is.
Thank you, everyone, for coming out. Thank you, Liz, for doing this event with me.
It's a pleasure. It's been a long time for me, too.
Yeah, this is my first time on stage to talk about my book ever. So
it's
thank
really
you
cool.
for being here for this.
I am moved to be here with you, and it's really nice to see all of you. And thanks for braving the cold night as well, multiple factors. And thanks, as always, to the Free Library. You guys do such a nice job with events.
Yes, thank you to the Free Library for hosting us.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.